Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on Community Radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We are the Donalana Kitchen. We are here in the studio of KHOI in beautiful downtown Ames, Iowa. This is Community Radio. We get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes, we do. The Donalana Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by Practical Farmers of Iowa, a member-based, farmer-led, nonprofit organization that has been strengthening farms and communities through farmer-led investigations and information sharing since 1985. You can find out more at their website, www.practicalfarmers.org.
And we thank them, and we thank you, our supporters and our listeners. The Donalana Kitchen talks about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. We talk about things around our kitchen table here. And today, I guess our thoughts go to spring, as in, where is it?
Oh. That curse words. Curse words.
Oh, okay.
Curse words.
We can say that.
At least it's sunny today, however.
It is. Things are looking up, although this has been a challenge.
Yeah, well, there's a report that it's going to snow again next Sunday like it did last Sunday.
Now, this is very odd. And for people that are starting seeds and thinking of spring, it's very disheartening.
Well, that's why we can't call it global warming.
Climate change. I think that we can talk about that. Yes, we can. Oh, snow.
Well, did you ever see anything like this in your life, Lana?
Well, I don't know. When you're young, snow happens and it's great. When you're old and kind of creaky, you think, oh, I don't like this.
Well, usually by mid-April, which we are rapidly approaching, we usually have full-grown lilacs blooming.
Right. I've been waiting for things to hop out of the ground and nothing's
happening.
Sure,
we don't even have daffodils yet.
Not yet.
But so, it will come.
It will.
It will come.
Right.
Persephone will return from the underworld.
Oh, you got a straight line to Persephone then. She knows she's coming then.
She told me. It's ancient. It always happens, you know. Just hang in there.
Good.
Okay.
Well, I had, instead of shoveling snow, I said to heck with that. And I went to an Iowa State University theater production this weekend. I saw Oklahoma.
Oh, fun.
It was a fine show, and I hear tell, I think, five productions at least.
With an agricultural theme, yes.
Yeah, it is.
Yes.
I think everything was sold out. I heard from some people that were in the show, and every blasted seat was taken, so good for them.
That's fun.
They had a huge cast, so I'm sure lots of moms and dads came into town for that. Good job, folks. So along with thoughts of spring and waking up those seeds. We'll be talking about some seed starting and thoughts of the garden later in the...
We are planning for an eventual spring.
But in the meantime, farmers all over Iowa are making plans. I don't think you get out in the field.
Farmers, they do have to plan on a much bigger scale than you and I, Lana.
Right. They're watching the weather and the soil... I don't even think it's thawed out yet, but maybe it is.
I don't know. They must be tearing out their hair.
It's an important resource, and we have to take care of it. Today, joining us here at the kitchen table, we're going to be talking about farmers and what gets grown out there and some new initiatives here. We're going to be talking to a relatively new member from Practical Farmers of Iowa. She's been with the organization for a year, year and a half, sort of, yes.
Well, at her age, that's a long time,
isn't it?
That's
a long time.
Isn't it, Alicia?
So welcome, Alicia. Alicia Bauer. She originally is from Wisconsin, a fine place to be from, and she came down here. She is the Strategic Initiatives Manager that connects. Her job is to connect up with industry to build markets for small grains and other things that farmers grow.
Oh, this is a good story. We're going to have a great interview today.
I'm excited to be here.
Good.
Well, the other part of her work, or maybe, I don't know, must come under strategic initiatives, it's cover cropping. So, Alicia, tell us, give us the quick non-farmer definition of cover cropping, what it does, how you do it, and why it's so important.
Great. Well, cover crops are basically a way of simulating what Mother Nature would do if left to her own devices. So if there's a prairie, there's never just bare earth sitting out there. But with our current cropping systems, even in your home garden, there's a lot of bare dirt sitting out there.
Oh, no, my garden is full of weeds.
Well, that could be another issue. But that's Mother Nature at work again,
right,
making sure that there's no bare dirt out there. So in order to make sure that that's not exposed to, you know, runoff and erosion in the wintertime, what we can do is plant a plant out there that will make sure that there's something growing, even though it's not a cropping season. So that's a cover crop.
For example, what do you – so this is something you put in the ground in the fall that starts to sprout enough, put some roots down, basically.
Yep.
And then, of course, you don't really see it all winter long. It still looks like there's nothing there.
Yeah.
Kind of.
For the most part, yep. It looks pretty brown, but then it greens up in the spring.
But it doesn't look freshly plowed or turned over, right?
Right. There's still a plant out there.
Okay.
So the most popular kind of plant that kind of grows under these conditions are winter small grains like cereal rye or winter wheat. So you plant them in the fall. They green up just enough to get themselves enough energy to withstand the winter. And then they're kind of laying in wait until spring happens. And then they're good to go. And they still, you know, start growing and get at it.
These small grains are actually pretty amazing when you think about it.
Small grains like
Rye, wheat, oats, barley, and triticale.
Okay, now, obviously, when you want to put your corn in, what do you do with the small grains that are sitting there?
Well, it depends on whether the farmer is conventional or organic. So in a conventional operation, usually they take out Roundup or another herbicide and spray the field and then plant into it. So the cover crop residue is usually still sitting there on the surface, but it's dying down. And then the new whatever they're planting in that field comes up through that. Now, if they're organic, obviously they can't use an herbicide. Mm-hmm. So what is commonly done in those systems is they actually use a roller crimper.
Oh, I love that term.
Yeah.
The roller crimper. Doesn't that give you an image?
Yeah.
Sounds like something you do to your hair.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yep. So what that does is it rolls the rye down and breaks the stem so that it can't keep growing once it's at a certain stage of its growth. So you can terminate it without using a chemical.
And then you can plant right into this. It's like a lawn or a carpet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like pre-mulching. So if you buy hay bales and, you know, spread them out in your garden to mulch it to keep weeds down, it's basically growing the hay and then just laying it down in the field so that you don't have to manually take it out there and spread it.
Well, now, and isn't there some nutritional advantage to the soil? Doesn't planting these crops, and even if you kill them with herbicide, does that add nutrient to the soil?
It does over the long term. So one way that the cover crop is helping the system is that it's sucking up all the water and the nutrients that are being created in that soil, even in the wintertime. So,
and holding them.
And holding them there. So then once it starts decomposing, it's re-releasing those nutrients back out into the system. So that's one way that it's helping the nutrients in the soil. And then another way is this thing we call soil organic matter, which is, you know, carbon is another soil
like
nutrient.
Composting kind
exactly.
of thing.
Exactly. So that's just created when there's plant biomass in the system.
And when you kill it, it goes in and it kind of ferments and degrades and adds all of those other little subtle elements back into the soil.
Right. And so because with a cover crop, you're growing biomass when there previously wasn't anything at all grown in that system, you're creating more organic matter that's going back into the soil.
So, a farmer obviously has to have a financial incentive for doing this. Now, other than – so when I think of cover crops, just the word cover, it feels like, oh, I'm laying a big blanket over my field. So one of the things, which is maybe difficult to calculate and is a long-term goal, is having those little rootlets in the soil prevents erosion, which is soil loss. So there's that very long-term benefit.
Right.
So for a farmer who owns his land, the long-term quality of the land is very important. Renting, that's a whole, you know, that's a little more iffy.
Yep.
Then you want to prevent erosion just because it's a good thing to do, right?
Right.
What else motivates farmers to do cover crops from a financial point of view?
Yeah, from a financial point of view, another benefit of having something intentional growing out there is that you don't get those weeds. So it's suppressing all those other nasty weeds that could that you might otherwise have to control by hand weeding or by using an herbicide, so that you can potentially reduce your expenses, either labor for hand weeding or herbicide, you know, the purchase of those inputs. So that's one way that it can help the bottom line. And another way that's very easy to make money on cover crops is actually to graze them.
Ah.
So, they're growing at a time of the year when not much else is green, when you would normally have to be feeding animals hay bales, mm-hmm. which is a very expensive thing to do.
Cattle and sheep.
Well, especially in the spring. My goodness, people get hungry and cattle get hungry, too.
Exactly.
And the price of hay bales goes up.
Mm-hmm. So that's another very easy way to make money quickly on a cover crop in a business.
And does it add enough soil fertility in its decomposition phase that it reduces the need for other fertility enrichments?
It depends on what kind of a cover crop it was. So for basically like what we've been talking about, the winter small grains, those really are not, releasing nitrogen in an amount that you could reduce fertilizer, which is what I think, we're kind of getting at
buckwheat
here.
Is buckwheat used? That's nitrogen, isn't it?
It's not a legume, so it's not fixing. It's not creating nitrogen.
So what cover crops would put more nitrogen in?
So those would be things like clover, hairy vetch, mm-hmm. Alfalfa, things like that. But the issue with those is that they really need to be in the field for longer.
A little bit. Oh,
so in order to really get to business and fixate that nitrogen. So it doesn't really work to plant it after corn or soybeans in the fall when you have a late harvest or Brussels sprouts, something that's very late harvested. Mm-hmm. It really works best if it's planted in like the first couple weeks of August, and then it has enough time to really, impact this nutrition by providing more nutrients to the soil. So then you need to be growing something like a small grain, like oats, that's harvested in July so that you can get out in the field and plant those legumes.
Oh, so there are crop rotations that can.
Yep, okay. Exactly.
Okay, now. While it sounds lovely to be growing oats and that sort of small grain kind of thing, especially if you're going to bring them to harvest, part of the problem in Iowa is that we have lost our infrastructure for processing oats, for example, and mm-hmm. marketing oats, for example, and even more so for small grains like wheats and things like that. So what are we going to do?
Well, this is what I spend a lot of time thinking about at the office.
So tell us how the future might unfold.
Yeah. So sort of one of the first things that we have to rebuild, as you're saying, is the aggregation and distribution of the small grains. So we still have a lot of the oat rollers, like the Quaker plant in Cedar Rapids in Iowa. But we don't – they're buying all of their oats out of Canada instead of aggregating them here in Iowa and then getting them to that facility.
Well, there's even an underlying research need for that. Before we get to that, one of the reasons among the fact that we've lost our infrastructure for carting the oats over to Cedar Rapids, as it were,
mm-hmm.
the oat varieties that have been grown in Iowa in the more recent history are not actually coming up to what is called test weight. They're not the quality
Correct.
That's used for food grade oats. Mm-hmm. So I know there's been some breeding going on at ISU and in other places to try to solve some of this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's complicated.
It is complicated.
We have lost a lot.
Yeah. So actually at ISU, we haven't had an oat breeder since the 60s. And
we used to have all this, folks.
we
and
did.
Not
we did.
That long ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things that Practical Farmers of Iowa has kind of tried to step up and lead on is performing variety trials here at a couple of different sites. We're actually adding a trial site in Ames this year, which is very exciting. So trying to kind of fill that gap that you're talking about, even with just breeding these plants for our modern conditions that we're dealing with in terms of weather and what the markets
are whatever
asking
those conditions
for.
May be.
Mm-hmm. As we are experiencing today. It's very strange. So,
and this is also true for what other small grains are farmers looking to bring to market here in Iowa besides oats?
Yeah. So I would say that oats is probably the big one because mm-hmm. it's naturally fits with our environment very well to grow it. But another one is actually cereal rye because it is just so hardy that it can survive the winter like no other winter small grain in Iowa. So it's, you know, from an agronomic perspective, it's a really attractive crop, but we've got to find markets for it. So then we're looking at things like selling it back for cover crop seed because cereal rye is the largest used cover crop mm-hmm, in the state mm-hmm. of Iowa, or actually, you know, feeding it to livestock mm-hmm. as part of their rations.
Okay, so that's another place that we don't have good research, correct, on the animal nutrition capacities for some of these small grains?
Correct, yeah.
And then there's beer brewing and whiskey making and a lot of other things
that
we could be doing. And last week we had on our show Steve Jones, who's a wheat breeder from Washington State, and our very own Iowa Earl Hafner, who has been growing wheat for a while and has built up his own milling service. So, I mean, there are things, but mm-hmm. it is a long, hard slog. Most farmers are not going to want to make the kind of investments that Earl, frankly, has had to make in
exactly.
order to market his wheat crop.
Mm-hmm.
But hallelujah for them, and we'll hope there's more of them.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that kind of grassroots, starting your own mill, you know, starting a local distillery or brewery, things like that are good first steps, you know, to kind of get the market.
They're expensive first steps.
Right. They're expensive first steps, and it kind of gets the market warmed up a little bit. But we do need those bigger players to come in and start buying more product in order to really make a landscape-level change that's going
to
affect.
Which leads us to your other job at PFI, right?
Yes.
Describe that one.
Yeah. So my colleague and I, Sarah Carlson, do a lot of work with companies who are interested.
I mean, mega companies.
Mega companies, like huge food and beverage companies.
Say a few of who they
yeah,
are, so people
work,
get the scale.
We work with Pepsi and Unilever are two of the big companies, and Unilever is the parent company of Hellman's Mayonnaise.
Among others. Many, many others. Yeah.
So when they have some sort of a corporate commitment to sustainability and they're trying to figure out how they're going to fulfill that commitment, we at PFI have kind of gotten a reputation for being really good at working with farmers and working with evidence-based research.
Describe an example of a commitment from, like, why does Hellman's Mayonnaise, what are they doing with farmers?
Yeah, so
you're thinking eggs? Canola oil? I don't know. What is it? What
mm-hmm.
are we talking about here?
So they use a lot of soybean oil in their mayonnaise.
Ah.
And in order to they have corporate commitments about improving water quality because that's very important to their, stakeholders.
Right. We got to backtrack and talk about put a quick one in is of why cover crops. Not only does it stop soil erosion, what else does it do? That's very important in Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
What is it?
Improves water quality.
How?
Because the plant is taking up nitrogen as it's growing in the field, it kind of holds that in place, as we talked about. And what would happen otherwise if that plant wasn't there is the rain would flush through that system and it would just carry all that nitrogen with it right out the tie lines and into the waterways. And so that's why we have such a problem with nitrates in our water supply in Iowa. So cover crops is a, you know, very effective strategy.
Filter
it's
system.
Basically a filter system, mm-hmm. exactly, to preventing that from getting into the water. So because Hellman's is so interested in water quality, and they buy a lot of soybean oil, they came to us and said, hey, we buy a lot of soybean oil from Iowa. What can we do to improve water quality with our farmers? And we said, well, hey, you can plant cover crops, and it's very, you know, effective. And they said, great, and then designed this program to provide cost share and agronomic support to farmers who are planting cover crops in their corn and soybean rotations.
Aha. Let's give a little shout out here to this program with these corporate responsibility standards has come from multiple years of work by Fred Kirschman at the Leopold Center. And then PFI is the part of the implementation of it. So this is not something that just happened.
Yeah.
Right.
It's been, you know, a lot of years of relationship building and, you know.
Research,
keeping
planning.
Keeping a good track record.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So then tell us, for example, what Pepsi wants to do.
So Pepsi is more interested in greenhouse gas emissions for their stakeholders.
Ho, 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 ho.
So
that's a whole other thing we didn't talk about.
Right.
Talk about how cover crops affect greenhouse gas emissions and climate change.
Mm-hmm. So the biggest, one of the biggest ways that agriculture contributes to climate change is from actually tilling the soil. When you till the soil, there's a lot of nitrous oxide and carbon dioxide that's released.
Soil is a, as we call it, a carbon sink. If we take the carbon out of the air and can keep it in the soil, it's all good.
Mm-hmm.
It's when the soil is disrupted and the carbon escapes from the soil. So the carbon in the air is not just from, you know, driving cars and things like that. Where agriculture is, it can be quite a problem is in turning the soil over enough that it's releasing the carbon into the air instead of, because photosynthesis, which is when you grow those cover crops or the corn or the soybeans, actually takes the carbon out of the air. Any green thing will take the carbon out of the air through photosynthesis and put it back into the soil.
Yep.
So by adding more time that green things are planted into the ground, we are actually not only preventing the carbon from getting out of the soil in the first place, but we are putting it back in. So thus the Pepsi incentive.
Yep.
Right?
Correct.
And so, and how are they incentivizing? Am I saying that word?
Yeah. I think so.
Okay, anyway.
Incentivizing.
How are they doing it?
Yeah, so they are also doing, you know, very similar program to Unilever where they are offering cost share and, you know, contracting with PFI to provide this network of peer and agronomic support to go along with it to make sure that people are having successful experiences when they try cover crops for the first time.
Great. We're here in the kitchen with Alicia Bauer. She's talking about some really fine programs to help our soil, help what grows in our soil, help the farmers, and lots of other things. We'll come back after this break. This is KHOI. This is Tasty Radio. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen.
Thank you.
Welcome back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. We are here around the kitchen table with Alicia Bauer. She is the Strategic Initiatives Manager. Oh, does that ever sound good? I'm glad she's on our side.
Big responsibility.
The Strategic Initiatives Manager for PFI. And her job is to connect up farmers and good research and good practices with some people in industry that could probably use our help. Yes, they could.
Right, before they destroy the earth.
Right.
Pardon me.
There is a term that we should talk about and probably define. The term is, should we be skeptical about this? Greenwashing. Some companies do this sort of thing because, oh, it looks good. You can make good TV spots about this and run nice music and say that they're helping the environment. Greenwashing is when they just do it because it looks good.
Yeah, it's kind of like pretending that you're nice when you're not. But corporate responsibility is a big deal these days because public opinion is important. Like if you look, for example, like the all the stuff that's gone on with gun control lately and how much the public outrage over the gun laws has forced corporations to take a different stand. Now, that, I think, is a good example. But, you know, corporations are not stupid. They're looking ahead. They want their customers to trust them. Trust is a big deal. It's always been a big deal. It is, in human nature, it is a big deal. So if you want to eat a product and it's coming from a company that you want to know how they're behaving, This is called corporate responsibility. So these corporations, and they are very large corporations, are quite motivated to look good and to behave well. So, for example, Alicia, when PFI takes these, because some of these initiatives are very important and they are very effective, but as a small nonprofit representing farmers, which can be a very small cog in this wheel, how do you guys decide whether this issue of corporate responsibility is appropriate for you guys to endorse and support and, be involved with?
Yeah. So I guess, you know, all of our drive as an organization comes from the farmers, what they want, what they need. And so we have that behind us when we are going to the negotiating table with these companies to design these projects.
You're not doing this if it's not going to sincerely help farmers.
Exactly. And the companies know that that is a great asset that we bring to the table when we're talking about what we're going to do. And so we are, committed to making sure that this is actually, going to benefit farmers.
Not just financially.
Right. And the other thing is that, PFI as an organization, since we were founded in 1985, has had a strong core commitment to using evidence-based, decisions, basically scientific research, randomized replicated trials. That's, a really strong part of our
does it
ideology.
Work and can we prove it?
Exactly. And mm-hmm. So when they are thinking about different, the companies are thinking about different practices that they could promote in order to reach these sustainability goals that they have, we can say, that one doesn't actually have that big of an impact.
Sketchy.
Yeah. That one, might be tiptoeing into that greenwashing area where you're taking an action, but it's not really having that big of an impact. But over here, cover crops, they have, this great impact. So like an example would be on water quality. The Iowa Nutrient Reduction Strategy did this great, fact-finding mission and all of this research.
Wait, who pays for that?
That was a, multi-sector investment. So that was government and nonprofits and the research institutions getting together to, work on it collaboratively. So, in that study, they looked at all these different types of interventions that could happen. And then the resulting reduction.
Define an intervention here so that we know.
So that's like, precision nitrogen fertilizer application.
Mm-hmm.
planting a cover crop, you know, doing a bioreactor or other sort of edge of field practice instead of an infield practice. So they, you know, had 10 or 12 of these different interventions, you know, these practices.
Things that farmers could tweak in their growing practices that could possibly improve
exactly
the water quality.
Yep. And they, you know, looked at it with a scientific lens and measured the impact that each of these things was having. So on the lower end of the spectrum in terms of impact was this precision nitrogen management.
Meaning it wasn't really that effective.
Right. So that has...
Sounds good, but not good enough.
Exactly. That usually has less than a 10% reduction in nitrate leaching into waterways. But then when
we could take the 10%.
We could take the 10%.
Yeah.
but it's better if you add that nitrogen management to cover crops, which have the potential to reduce nitrogen leaching by 30%.
Woohoo!
So that, you know, it's a much bigger number that we're talking about.
And this is really good to know, you know. This is not, let's try this and let's try. We're talking about agricultural practices that at least in Iowa, we want to initiate statewide. Now, obviously, these can be applied all across the Corn Belt. This is very, very important work.
Yeah. So at the design table, when we're thinking about what kinds of practices companies can invest in, we start with this evidence to kind of make sure that we're getting the bang for our buck in terms of the impact and, you know, actually.
Makes them look better, too, doesn't
it? Exactly. Then they have bigger impacts that they can claim. And then on the back end of that, so once we plant the cover crops, they're out there in the field, the farmers are participating in the programs, then we're actually doing data collection and measuring the impact
to prove it and validate.
Exactly.
Okay. And I don't know if this is proprietary information, but can you give me, like, for example, a ballpark number of, say, what either Pepsi, you don't have to say the company, but what kind of money are we talking about for a corporation to invest in this kind of practice?
Well, the amount of cost share per acre is $10. Per acre, and they are looking to work with, you know, 200 farmers per year, and they can get that cost share on up to 10% of their acres. So if I can, you know, do quick mental math or maybe cheat and get my calculator out here.
Well, plus they're paying to do the calculations and the science behind
exactly.
it also, right?
Right. So, you know, probably somewhere around $500,000, you know, and with about $300,000 of that going directly to farmers.
Okay. And then, so that's a, you know, for those big corporations, it's a drop in the bucket, but it's certainly, we like that drop in our bucket.
Exactly. That's what's going to fill it.
Good. So in your job, what you're managing, you're implementing these programs with the farmers, you're managing the communications with the corporations.
Yep.
Sounds like fun to me.
Ha! I think so.
Good. And we're coming on to a growing season. I'm sure there's much going on. Practical Farmers is a good resource for lots of different things. And although you said it's not ready now, there's all sorts of information that PFI shares with farmers and the public. They have a series of field days coming up, and all sorts of information can be shared, although the field day schedule is in progress right now.
It's in progress, yes.
That's good.
So, and we will report on field days as they make a little guide. It will be on the website.
Yep.
It's also published. I get one in the mail when it happens.
Good. It's exciting to know that this sort of thing is going on. Do you have anything else to say about all the fun stuff that you're doing at PFI? Oh, I want to mention, you are in brand new expanded offices. I think it's so nice when an organization just gets too big for its britches. Yes, and they have to move.
It's more very corporate-looking offices. So when you entertain... You know, the Unilever people, you know, you look very substantial.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
How many people are on staff now?
Oh, gosh. I think we're up to 17 or 18.
And, you know, this is a growing organization. We're very proud of Practical Farmers of Iowa.
Well, we are glad.
Certainly a privilege to work there.
Fantastic. That's good. And sounds like you're on your way to do great things to connect up farmers with corporations, to connect up farmers with growers.
One thing we didn't mention, I know you have the statistics for the percentage of cover crops in the state of Iowa.
Oh, yeah.
Tell me how many we had, how many we're going to have, how's it looking?
All right. Well, the numbers aren't exciting. I'll preface that before I say them. So last year we did a cool study with satellites to measure, from the distance, the amount of acres out there with cover crops on them. And we found that only 2.6% of corn and soybean acres in Iowa had cover crops on them in the winter of, 2016 going into 2017.
Well, better than a sharp poke in the eye.
So we know that we've got a long way to go. Our goal would be to get up to about 40% of those acres in order to, achieve the nutrient reduction strategy goals.
So at 40%, it will prove that we can have a major benefit to water quality for everyone in Iowa, right?
Right. Right. With the other practices that are recommended in the nutrient reduction strategy, that would mitigate the nitrate problem in our water supply.
Yeah. All right. So folks, you're getting in on the beginning of this story. We are only at 2%, but we will grow it to 40%.
Yes.
And we will be here on the Donalana Kitchen reporting about it all the way along. Just stick with us, folks.
Very good. Alicia, give us the website, or how can we contact PFI for those that are interested in this sort of thing?
Right. Yeah, the website is practicalfarmers.org, and we've got all of our research reports and information about our programs there. It's a great place.
And the Field Day Guide will be coming out.
It's kind of, you can really get lost on there for a couple hours getting through all of that stuff. And then if you're also just interested in, maybe you've got some questions for us, the number at the office is 515-232-5661, and we'll get you hooked up with somebody who has some knowledge in what your questions are.
And the beauty of the Field Days, and this is, it's good for kids too, their families that bring children. You
yep.
get to go to a farm and really start to understand what we're doing here in Iowa, you know?
Yeah. And, I've talked a lot about, large scale field crops, corn, soybeans today, but we do programming around livestock, around horticultural crops,
vegetables,
like fruits and vegetables,
flowers,
any and all of those things. Yeah.
Could little be. Lammies, mm-hmm. all kinds of. And there actually are going to be some sort of general interest field days for non-farmers this year on talking about food systems. I know there's going to be one in Southwest Iowa, I think in the middle of August.
That sounds right.
The Ag Arts Field Day.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that will be in there. And even if you don't want to, the science of it is not something you want to wrap around, just going to the farm is always a wonderful experience.
Yeah, we have a value of welcoming everyone.
Yes, we do. Well, thank you for being with us today. It's always nice to hear what's going on out in the field. This is KHOY 89.1 Community Radio, and this is the Donalana Kitchen. If you want to find more about this radio station, go to khoifm.org, and you can find the Donalana Kitchen webpage there. There's recipes, there's archives. Yes, there is. We're back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. This is spring. Believe it or not, this is spring. I'm planting seeds. I've got a greenhouse. I'm sticking things in the ground.
You bet she's planting seeds. Yeah. Okay, here's the question of the season. Are you ready, Lana?
Yeah.
How many varieties of tomatoes are you growing this year?
32 and counting.
Up from last year.
But see, what happens is that I plan and everything is all labeled. And then I get carried away and plant some more. And then people start giving me seeds. You got to try this one. You got to try that one.
Well, you know, I didn't give you tomato seeds.
I know.
I would never presume to give Lana tomato seeds.
But still, it's just a joy to do that sort of thing, to be part of a living thing. That's why I like to garden. And yes, Donna got all excited, and she gave me some seeds. Tell me about what you passed on.
Oh, boy. Well, you know, in the little chefy world and all the websites that I read and stuff like that, there came this email about a new company called Row 7, okay? And our story, as they say on the website, is that some plant breeders at Cornell have been working with Chef Dan Barber, who's, of course, the darling of the farm-to-table movement. And they have been working on, guess what, vegetables that taste good.
Oh, bless her heart.
Yeah, right. Okay. What a concept. Duh. However, it's a good concept, right?
I like it.
So, of course, I started reading about it. And there's not a lot of seed selections on their website, but, you know, I started reading them and I got quite suckered in. For example, I bought something called the Badger Flame Beet. Now, since I don't grow vegetables, I bought some for four different vegetable grower friends of mine around town, hoping that they would plant them and then I will get to taste these. Because these, first of all, the picture is gorgeous. They're kind of a very bright orange, not the magenta that you usually have to. But the thing that got me about the Badger Flame Beet was it's supposed to be, I'll read the package. Okay. All the vegetal sweetness of a beet without the polarizing earthiness. The brilliant Badger Flame is here to redeem the beet's dirty reputation. So this is supposed to be such a good beet that here's the recipe, and this would probably be vetted by Chef Dan Barber. Slice thin, serve raw with salt, pepper, lemon juice, and olive oil. So a beet that's so flavorful that you can eat it raw was completely intriguing to me.
See, that's what, in the spring, when you read things online or you see all these new seeds being coming out, it gets everybody all excited. And people like me who love to grow things, thank you, Donna.
Oh. The other thing that I got, I'm going to read this from the website. Okay, so this is a 7082 cucumber. It says experimental, and it says, breaking cukes out of the banal, this experimental green slicer explores the bold and complex flavors long forgotten in cucumbers. Okay, who doesn't want to try this cucumber? Ha ha. Okay, so I did it, and bless all my friends that are going to grow these things. And if they really, really taste exceptionally, you will be hearing back from us again. The cucumbers take 58 days to maturity. Of course, at this point, we don't know what the start date is, but Lana is ready to go, and a couple of other, I've given some to Helen Gunderson, so Helen will give us a report on these seeds, and Gio and Paula, our lovely Georgian Catalan friends, are also going to grow some of these seeds, so let's see what we get.
It's nice to kind of spread your seeds around. I think that's what PFI talks about, the non-replicated or the replicated trials. You try it out in a lot of different
gardens.
Yes,
we're going to try it in the three or four gardens around town and see if this is just a marketing ploy or if, in fact, these are spectacular.
So a test is coming up with beets. I want to have
And if you want to look that up, just Google Row 7. In case you want to try some of them, too.
Like seven like the number?
Like seven like the number.
Okay, got it. I want to mention about beets. I'm always kind of leery about planting beets. It's one of those tricky sort of vegetables for me to grow. So I looked up my favorite seed starter handbook here by Nancy Bubel. I get that out every year because she's got advice for planting things and growing vegetables and herbs and perennials. And I looked up beets.
See how complicated it is? I just think, I'll buy the package and Lana will do it.
It's not magic. You have to know how to treat these little suckers here, these little beets. beets, you can plant in the garden when it's pretty cool yet, around the when the frost stops.
So we can't do it yet.
Well, soon.
Okay.
Now, beets are notorious for spotty germination, and that is my experience. They're hard little seeds. And you can pre-soak the seeds, and that helps. That helps with a lot of different things.
Says germination rate 94%.
Well, I will hold them to it.
And this is a package of 100 seeds. Mm-hmm. So I expect 97 beets.
Oh, gosh, look at that. All right. So after I do, I'll soak them. Or here's a note. It says you can crush the beet seeds lightly with a rolling pin and to encourage more complete germination. Beet seeds, believe it or not, are not actually one beet in each seed. Beet seeds are actually a seed ball. There is an aggregate of 2 to 6 individual seeds.
Oh, so I'm going to get more than 97
beets. Well,
now
don't get all excited here. That's why they're such
Am I counting my chickens before they hatch?
That's why they're kind of tricky, because you plant, and if they get all that germination happening, they're growing too close together because everything comes from one little point. So that's why you generally have to go through and thin beets out.
Well, I bet we could eat the thinned ones.
We could.
Because I bet the tops, maybe the tops even taste good.
I bet they do. So that idea of a beet seed, it's kind of this rumply little hard thing. It's got lots of little possibilities in it. And that's why even if you plant the beets in a row, they'll come up really, really thick. And you do have to thin them up. You can, if you're very careful, you can replant those little things that you pull up.
Whoa.
It's okay. You can do that. Or, like Donna said, just eat them. That's good, too.
Right, because immature beet tops are actually quite tasty.
They're actually quite very tasty. Uh-huh. Yes, they are. And I don't know about other people's gardens, but I farm in the country. I've got deer. I've got woodchucks. I've got rabbits. And they like beets almost as well as I do.
Ooh.
So I will plan on putting I don't know what I'll do this year, whether I'll put a little tent of chicken wire over it or whether I'll make hoops and add some row cover over it. But I do cover that and chard. They love chard leaves.
Also, beets and chard are very difficult with the wild beasties.
Oh, yeah. Well, they like them. They like food, too. But, yes. And somehow I can always tell when the deer have been in the garden because they just kind of put their head down and go right down the row.
Well, I hope it's not ungenerous of me, but I don't want to feed these
beets. Oh, all right. I will cover it. Okay. I will cover them. And that probably will ensure that I'll get some beets, too. So we'll give these beets a try. They are called Badger Flame Beet and Orange Beet. And we'll see if we really, really, truly can eat them raw. Looking forward to that. That is good.
And that is row 7 seeds. Just Google row 7 seeds if you want to try some of the. And there are a few other things, too. We got a habananda pepper, which is supposed to have it's called "This Heartless Hero Captures the Floral Behind-the-Scenes Sweetness of the Famous Habanero, Minus the Burn."
Okay. I like it.
We'll give it a try.
I like hot peppers, but I don't go crazy over super hot. So,
yeah, and these are the not super hot.
Okay. And I've got...
This should be good for Iowa palates.
That's true. Our bar for hot is kind of low here. So there we go. Oh, we have another news item. The Donna Lana Kitchen News Desk came up with something that Donna sent me on the internet. And it's this...
A new bit of research. Oh, yes.
This is article that researched washing dishes, couples washing dishes. Now, since this is a kitchen program, we're here at the kitchen table, doing dishes is one of these social studies. Everybody has an opinion here. So what does this say, Donna?
Okay. This comes from The Atlantic magazine, and the headline is, "Doing Dishes is the Worst." And now, this is an empirically proven fact. Dishwashing causes more relationship distress than any other household task. I guess they gave up on toilet cleaning. But then again, dishes happen every day. So, the report from the Council of Contemporary Families, a nonprofit that studies family dynamics, suggests that, here's the conclusion. You're going to Now, this might seem obvious to you, Lana, but there obviously is a whole part of the population that doesn't get this yet. So it concludes that the more the task is shared, the idea was that if the couple both does the dishes together and the woman does not feel like it's her sole responsibility to cook the food and then clean after, apparently the net result is you have better sex.
Well, write
and
that
down.
And that's
a proven fact.
All
no,
right.
I mean, it does say the report is more harmony in the family, happier marriages. And then it does say that apparently doing dishes together is the new foreplay.
Oh, I like that.
Who would have thought? Well, actually, that
makes sense because there's a lot of other little chores around the house.
It's a way of showing that you care for each other, which is always, you know, the ongoing things that build relationships, as we all know, are in the small details of life. So doing dishes, guys, listen up. This is an easy one. It is a slam dunk. If you do the dishes, guess what might happen? Dot, dot, dot.
You get clean dishes.
That's right.
Okay.
There you go. Okay. All right. And this is scientifically proven. Okay.
We've been talking about scientific stuff today. We talked about cover crops and outreach to industry and marketing for small grains and beets. And we've talked about
hopeful for spring for the beets to sprout.
Yeah.
Oh, I have one more question, Lana.
Yes.
Nasturtium planting.
Yes.
Okay. It is one of the things that I do plant. And usually I soak the little round seeds in a cup overnight, and then I just stick them in the ground about maybe a half an inch or less down and cover them up. But it's so – normally I would have already put them in the ground. When should I do this?
Oh, wait till it thaws out. I'd give it a week or two yet. My goodness.
Come on, sunshine.
This has been the Donalana Kitchens. Thanks for joining us today. Upcoming, we're going to be having a KHOI fundraiser beginning April 16th. You can support community radio.
Yes, that is a fundraiser. We are going to raise a little fun.
Fun here with a fundraiser because this is community radio. We can't do it without you. You've heard music by a number of neat people here. We had the band Lunasa, the band, the house band. And we also are going to go out with a fiddler named Liz Carroll with a cup of tea. My name is Lana Nachtigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had great engineering by Kobe Gaines. Eat good food and enjoy life.